Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 95 featuring Moby Frankie, who is over at Riot now, but mostly known for his work that he's done at Valve. And he's done some, he's a concept artist, as many of you may know. He's done a lot of great work on Team Fortress and Half-Life 2. And as I don't know if you guys know, but Half-Life 2 is very, very important game. And he knew that when he got there and he got involved in it. And it's the reason it's important is specifically because of its aesthetics and the way it looks. And it made him realize that video games is actually an amazing place for concept artists and for incredible design. And that's what he does. He has an incredible eye. He was not a speaker. He was at THU this year, which is where I met him. And he's not a speaker at THU. He was helping up with Colabs, which he will talk about during the podcast. But he has been in a speaker at THU in the past, and he's been a, you know, tribe member for a while. Love his work. Super nice guy. And he has an incredible story. You know, he was born in Washington, D.C. and grew up in the Caribbean, and not necessarily as privileged as you'd think. In fact, well, not very privileged at all. And it was part of those adversarial moments that sort of made him the person he is now, and sort of be able to find a strength and you know, overcome a lot of those issues. Really fascinating story. It reminded me a lot of the incredible story we heard from Igor Nezevich. So for those of you who enjoyed the Igor podcast, you'd probably enjoy this one a great deal as well. Really love talking to Moby and talking about that stuff. And speaking of THU, the promo we've been doing for a while is still available. So if you guys want to be able to get a THU TV at a discount, there's going to be some incredible content coming up. You'll get it now if you order now, or you'll get it later when it comes out. It doesn't matter. But make sure and go to trojan-unicorn.com/TV and use the promo code CG Garage, all one word, to get the discount. That's 20% off you can get on THU TV, which is a pretty good deal. So remember, once again, it's trojan-unicorn.com/TV and use the promo code CG Garage and get your 20% discount. All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed. I got three more podcasts coming out on THU TV, so you should have a lot more really interesting stuff coming up. I know a lot of you have enjoyed these podcasts because I've been seeing the numbers and they're way up this time. So you guys are really enjoying it. So, all right, thanks so much, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I'm sure a lot of these guys are, and gals are, you know, listening while they're working, perhaps.
Or, yeah, or on the drive, which is what I do.
Okay.
In LA.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, I don't even have a car.
Really? Where do you live? Where do you live in LA?
I live in Santa Monica, and you know, right near the beach. And my bike is my car.
Right. So you bike to work?
Bike to work. Yeah, I bike to the supermarket. It's kind of custom made, so it has like a cargo hold on it, so right. I can actually like put groceries or whatever, you know, wow. Painting supplies.
That is quite bold. I guess Uber makes it a little bit easier if you have to get around a little
bit.
Yeah,
and
right?
If I have to get around, or like, you know, if friends come into town or whatever, then I can go up to, you know, rent a car.
Right. So
it's all good.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Mm. I'm just kind of like, you know, the world's going to shit as well. So,
right.
You know, they talk about global warming and the fracking situations and the polluting of the waters and the air. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to take some time for tea with this one.
I signed up for the Tesla Model 3.
Yeah. That's another good option.
Yeah.
Of course.
I told myself, because I drive a Hummer? I drive a stick shift.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
And I said, if ever I'm giving up a stick shift, it's going to be for an electric car.
And you know, the stick shift is the best because it keeps you awake. You have more control over your vehicle, right?
People say, how can you drive a stick shift with all the traffic in LA? I said,
You gotta do something.
I'd be falling asleep if I.
Most people, of course, are on their texting. So anybody who's driving right now, please do not do that. It makes me so angry. See how accidents all the time cause from it.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So I think what a lot of people like when we do these, they like to hear a little bit of the origin stories, the backstories.
Sure.
So and what's awesome is that a lot of people have listened to them. Of people they've known for years and years and years. And I never knew that about that person. So they really kind of like those stories.
Excellent. Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, for me, I mean, I think everybody's born pretty, you know, pretty much the same. We're empty in some ways and we fill up. I was born in Washington, D.C., but I grew up with my parents who were both artists. One was, my dad was a potter.
Oh, you
know,
really?
Classically trained, you know.
Nice.
Yeah. So he was an amazing.
Yeah. Amazing my wife guy. Did pottery. It's amazing work. Yeah.
I mean,
on each side of me are potters as well.
That's
and one of
fantastic.
Them has a kiln in their in their garage.
Wow, be careful of that. Yeah. That shit's dangerous.
It's hot.
But yeah, my dad's this, you know, was a very, you know, classically trained guy. Traditional. And my mom was teaching her how to do pottery and illustration. We grew up in a Civil War hospital, actually.
Really?
Yeah, in the hinterlands of Washington, D.C., about a half an hour outside of the city. And that was pretty magical. Like, we grew up pretty poor.
Sure.
Right? So toys were very rare in the family, which was kind of cool because my brother and I, we'd make stuff.
Right.
You know, we'd make stuff out of wood and use our imaginations and do a lot of art. I ended up selling my first painting, I think it was at the age of 3, for $75, you know?
Really? Which,
yeah. Like my mom, you know, we definitely used it for groceries,
sure.
Right?
Three, that's awesome.
Yeah, no, it was awesome. It was a cool experience. I remember it and kind of being proud about it, you know, you're a little kid, you kind of feel. But anyways, yeah, my dad ended up leaving in 77, you know, and so it was just my mom, my brother and I in this little farm, you know, in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
And so we struggled again, you know, even more for the next couple of years until my mom was like, screw this, I need to go someplace. And so she wanted to, you know, she wanted to be an illustrator and a watercolorist. And so she was invited to move down to the Caribbean. To
really?
The Virgin Islands, yeah. So St. Thomas.
Uh-huh.
So in 1979, we flew down there, and that was my home for the next 18 years.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So imagine like going from this rural backwater, you know, to the Caribbean. You know, it was just like this really intense.
What did she do in Virgin Islands?
Again, it was like even like more struggle because now it's like we had no car. We were hitchhiking a lot. You know, we moved around the island. It was really tough for the first couple of years.
Right.
Like a lot of hitchhiking, I remember. Like hitchhiking to school with my mom, you know, holding my hand to get down there and stuff. So it was crazy. When she met my stepdad and, you know, they've been together ever since, you know. And so he kind of gave us a lot of stability, obviously, to have a relatively normal life thereafter. But yeah, you know, and obviously, like, I've always been very interested in art. But I never thought, whatsoever that I was going to, you know, be able to become one, you know, a professional artist. And what does that even mean?
Well, the thing is, that's the thing, right? So a lot of people say, I want to be an artist. And everyone's like, they imagine someone who is struggling, trying to sell one painting after another, right?
Yeah, the starving artist.
The starving artist scenario. This is the picture they have in mind, not realizing that absolutely everything that they touch in this world was designed or created by an artist.
That's a fantastic point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, you know, people say, oh, you're never going to make it. And the reality is like, yeah, like we're in this room right now in this amazing hotel in Portugal, right? And
this bowl here.
This
was
bowl,
designed. Yeah.
The glass. Everything, right? Everything around us. And there's a place. And what does art do, right? It I mean, it surrounds us.
Right.
It can add great joy. It can sometimes make us sad. You mm-hmm. know, sometimes it's extremely functional.
Right.
At the same time as being beautiful.
Yeah. It makes your world beautiful.
It does.
Yeah.
It does. I mean, and granted, like, nature's a beautiful thing as well.
but you still had a passion for art, right?
Oh,
so you were
yeah.
still creating. Were you still painting at this point or drawing?
Yeah. Oh, doing a lot. Yeah. I mean, I would be in my mom's studio. She was fantastic. I mean, mm-hmm. She was self-taught, but she was doing, you know, I mean, her stuff was actually really, like, kick-ass good. Like,
right.
she naturally knew how to do pen and ink, like,
okay.
without books. So she was, like, doing these beautiful pen and ink drawings of, you know, it's all colonial. The town of Shah Ramali has all these, like, colonial buildings from the 1500s, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, this, you know, she could explore. But yeah, I continued on all throughout. But yeah, and I remember I was horrible in school. I think just something in me. I was just I was horrible at math. I'd get straight Fs.
Really?
Nice. Yeah, it was getting bad. And you know, I mean, I got beat up a lot when I was a kid because you know it was like sometimes the only white kid in school.
Wow.
At some places, you know, it didn't make me, you know. Become a racist or anything.
Sure.
I understood, you know, these
yeah.
things happen, right?
Right.
But things got really difficult, you know, for me at school. So I ended up dropping out in 10th grade.
Okay.
But that was due to Hurricane Hugo.
Oh, right.
You know, 1989.
Yeah.
And I had to stay at our island. And so I just worked on construction and all that stuff. So then I really was like, okay, I'm not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. Now I'm really just, I think I'm just going to... I'm going to be doing this kind of work for forever.
Right.
But, you know, you fast forward a couple of years later.
Right.
I ended up getting my GED anyways, but like, and I'd just been over like this horrible relationship with this girl. You know, we met when I was 17.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she wasn't horrible, but I think we were just young.
Mm-hmm.
I broke up with her at 23, or 22. My brother literally liked... rescued me. He's
okay.
like, okay. So he's like, it was, you know, it was in the summertime of 2015. And he said, look, dude, I'm leaving next year.
Okay.
And I was like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm going to art school. I was like, what? You're going to go to art school.
Right.
And he's like, look, it's easy. You just take out financial aid. I mean, and financial aid was very easy to get back then,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the 90s, you know, with mm-hmm. under Clinton's initiatives. We made that happen. I went to the Academy of Art, and just to make a long story short, mm-hmm. in that context, you know, we went through a 5-year program.
Okay.
So it was intensive, and fantastic in the sense that we didn't learn any digital
okay.
media. And I was studying to be an illustrator, you know, fine art / illustration guy. Mm-hmm. And it was building these wheelhouses in me of, you know, color theory, right? But you're doing that non digitally, right? It's
right.
analog. Everything's analog, and there's no control delete.
Right.
I see that now. Everybody's doing digital as this this way of getting faster. But there is something amazing about doing things traditionally that really does teach you about like color theory. You cannot like understand color if you don't touch it, right?
Right.
It actually has its own little you know, expression, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you mix ultramarine blue, watercolor perhaps,
yeah.
and alizarin crimson, they sing together because they're both cool colors.
Right.
One's a cool red, one's a cool blue, right?
Right.
And then if you mix a cadmium red, which is a little bit warmer,
yeah.
or a red orange with an ultramarine, it turns into this grayish purple,
right?
And so you learn all those, and those aren't, that's not right or wrong, right? But it's
right.
like one mixes more of a gray and the other one makes this extremely vibrant color.
Right.
But it, you know, it's not like, oh, I'm going to have to download some painting software
right.
to make this thing happen.
Spin the wheel of
Yeah, and spin that. Yeah, exactly. And you're like, oh, I got it. No, it's a little bit, that's too easy.
Right.
You yeah. got to do the Mr. Miyagi approach, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wax on, wax off. And so 5 years of that,
mm-hmm.
I remember I was in art school, and this is the year before I graduate, and
okay.
I'm flossing my teeth. And I had really, like, I was having teeth problems anyways, because
mm-hmm.
I guess from the Caribbean, like, no real dentist or anything. So,
mm-hmm.
and I would floss, I'd brush my teeth,
mm-hmm.
pulling down with my floss, and like half of my tooth comes off. It's like one of those nightmares that you have.
Yeah,
you
know, when you're losing your teeth, when you dream about that, that's like,
yeah, that's
scary shit.
Right, scary shit. And you're like, oh shit, okay. And now I have this like literally like a glass shard in my mouth.
Ah.
I was like, I walked out and I showed my brother and I lived together, and I was like, dude, my tooth just fell. And he's like, oh shit. We had no health insurance or anything, right. And we're living in San Francisco, which, you know, at that time, it's like during the dot-com thing, things are expensive, not as expensive as here now. And I go to a dental school, and they're like, dude, we can't do anything about it. Sorry, like, nobody's really qualified to, like, help out with your situation. Mm-hmm. So I had that for a year. And so it started to, like, abscess, right? And I was, like, desperate, like, and I'm 29 years old.
Uh-huh.
And I talked a little bit about this at THU last year, but I let's see. By 29, I was then later on that year, I was living in a bunk bed.
Uh-huh.
You know, with this guy, you know, I'm 29, right? Like when I should have like my own little apartment or have at least my own room.
Sure.
I'm in a bunk bed, right?
Right.
September 11th happens, my girlfriend breaks up with me, and it's just like, and I got this damn rotting tooth, right? And that's not fun, right? And I'm trying to get a job. I'd graduated by that time. And it's like nothing, like, I mean, not just September 11th, right? But there was the crash.
Right.
Right? The financial crash that had happened in 2001. So, was it 2000? I can't remember. But anyways, like, it was just like, there's really tough. And so Pixar actually ended up calling.
Really? Out of nowhere?
Out of nowhere.
Wow.
I think a friend had told them maybe about some of my stuff from, you know, from art school or whatever.
Okay,
so
okay.
I ended up going there with a portfolio that was just not geared for Pixar, unfortunately.
Okay.
When they call, you go.
Right, of course. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. So the portfolio was just not.
Don't say, can you call me back in a year and get my shit together?
That's really what I should have done. But they, you know, they set that up for me anyway. So they just said, here, you know, you've got your chops. You just have to come back with something that's really geared towards for this.
Okay.
So I started working on that, right? And I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. And so like 8 months later, I'm getting my portfolio further along. Mm-hmm. By this time I'd moved in with my uncle who lived across near Oakland or near Berkeley.
Right.
And my friend from this place up in Seattle called Valve calls, and he's like, dude, you've got to come up here. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to work for no game company. I was like, dude, I want to work for Pixar. He's like, no, come. Just come up.
Okay.
And quick. So I was like, okay. And it would be nice to see him anyway. So I go up there and...
And he had gone to school with you? Is that how you met him?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, like really fantastic fellow. And then, so I go there and I see what I'm going to be working on. It was, you know, an early version of Team Fortress.
Okay.
I was not excited about it. I hate to say it. However, then I met the art director there. His name was Viktor Antonov.
Mm-hmm.
And he pulls me into a room and he's like, hey, can I show you something? And he shows me this early version of Half-Life 2.
Right.
And it's this scene of City 17, mm-hmm. and he's spinning it around in this world, and I'm just like, wait, what? this isn't a video game that I'm, you know,
yeah.
In the context, I didn't know that like video games could have this type of craftsmanship, because like they were basing that world on an obscure European city,
mm-hmm.
And the concept of it was somewhat of like a 1984 scenario. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, this is so sophisticated. I want to be a part of that.
Right.
And so I immediately, you know, I,
yeah.
And luckily I had my portfolio there. And
but had you done any digital at this point?
I did a little bit.
But like were mostly an analog guy still.
Mostly an analog. Yeah. I mean, I played with Photoshop, to the best of my ability, which was pretty low standard at that point. Like I didn't know how to use the layers, pen sensitivity. I just didn't know how to set it up. I just thought, oh, you just draw with it, and it was terrible. I was really bad. So I came in, they asked me, said like, do you know Photoshop? And I was like, yes, I do. I didn't.
Right.
And that you know, that was something that like immediately I could tell they saw happen. They're like, right. Oh, this guy's really not perform, you know?
Right.
And I was in a room with a guy named Isaac, who's, you know, like cranking out. His name was Isaac Hennefort. And he's cranking out these amazing like concepts in Photoshop. Right. Boom. And I'm like, how are you doing this? And he's like setting this, he sets up Photoshop for me. Or, you know, using the Wacom tablets mm-hmm. back then. And I still was like, oh, this is really painful. I don't like it. And he's just flooring me all the while. So I went home one night just really down, right? Because mm-hmm. I couldn't draw on it. And I came back the next day with, you know, my gouache book and gouache paintings. Right. And I was like, I'm just going to do it this way now for a while.
You're going to sit immediate, right?
I'm just going to do it like, and the thing was, is that like, he turned around and I remember at the end of the day and I had three concepts done.
Right.
And he's like, what the hell, man? Like, wow. Like, how do you do that? Because before it was me asking, how did you
do Photoshop? And he's like, how the hell did you do that with gouache? And gouache is not friendly either.
No, it's not friendly. It can be a little brat. But yeah, I mean, that kind of initially started, you know, I'd go into meetings and, you know, we're discussing with the team and everybody would print out their work and I didn't have to print it out. I just cut it out of the book and I would, you know, I'd have a nice little stack and I'd throw them out there. And people just would tend to gravitate more towards.
Yeah, they hadn't seen that before.
Yeah, yeah. So it kind of started a little bit of a discussion of like, whoa, so you're not using like some guys were doing more photorealistic, quote unquote, concepts.
Sure.
And there I was using these more like basic shapes and you know, more blocky, chunky character proportions. And
right.
And then we started, like, everything kind of starts shifting over into this direction now.
Okay. People starting to pick up gouache over a vowel then?
No. People weren't, no.
Okay.
But it was a great tool for me to, just as far as getting that initial character design process down, you know, just help me.
And you were doing this on Half-Life 2, right?
This was actually on Team Fortress, the very early phase.
Okay.
And then I remember Gabe came down one day.
Who's Gabe?
Okay. Gabe Newell, I'm sorry. Yeah, so he's the owner of Valve.
Okay.
And wonderful guy. And he basically says, like, look, you know, Half-Life's doing really, like, we're trying to develop this thing. We really need to move it along. If we don't, you know, the company's going to go down.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. And so everybody jumped on board, which was my dream.
Right.
I was like, oh my gosh, I finally get to work with Victor and I get to be a part of that. And that's exactly what happened. You know? So we were, my friend Ariel Diaz and I were responsible of retooling all of the citizens of Half-Life 2, and some of the main characters. And then after we shipped Half-Life 2, we had a couple of months of, you know, kind of rest, mm-hmm. relaxation. And instead of doing that, we picked it up again. We picked up Team Fortress.
Okay.
But we ended up going back to the drawing board. It was just a small group of artists. And so what we wanted to do is we basically just wanted to take the original Team Fortress and do a visual upgrade.
Okay.
And that was it. Like we'd spend 6 months and we just do a visual upgrade and
bring
that
it up,
and that then ended up turning into Team Fortress 2 and boom and that was a lot of fun. And then you know we'd move on to other different products, and so I'm learning not just how to do realism stuff, I'm doing stylized stuff, and every game has its own gameplay constraints.
It's, you know, I remember I think it was a DD when Half-Life 2 came out. So what year did Half-Life 2 come out? Was it
2005.
2005, right. Okay. Yeah. Nothing looked like that at all, ever. I mean, it was like suddenly people were saying, oh, games may actually start to become photoreal, you know, or have an element of realness and they look good and the textures were higher res and everything was kind of, it had some aspect of that looked like there was global illumination involved. You know, it was beautiful. But it was also a time I remember where people were waiting to download it. and they would, it was one of those, I think it was one of the first games where you could buy it and then it will automatically download at midnight or whatever.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I know that that was, I mean, I felt so bad for people because they want it. They want it so bad.
And then I think there was about 12 people at DD that just didn't come in the next day.
Yeah. There were people. Yeah. Yeah. I remember a lot of people.
That was really great. And it's so, it was really, really cool. Really cool. Yeah, so that was a very, very important game. It was amazing that you got to be part of that. It was like your second big project, right?
Yeah, well, actually, it was really my first. Like,
I mean, I guess it is, right?
Yeah, in a sense, because that other version of Team Fortress was, it was just kind of a, I mean, that was coming towards the end of that life of that, for that version anyways.
Okay.
And I wasn't learning much at that time. As far as you know, game development is concerned,
right?
Because I was also, you know, very junior at that time.
Yep.
However, working under like strict time constraints on something that, like, you know, like again, like when Gabe said, if this doesn't ship, Valve no longer exists.
Right.
And so you have that fire under your feet, and you really like you start really challenging your brain to a level that you're. You just never have done before, and because you don't want it, you know, you don't want the company to fail,
right?
You want it to win, and you want, you know, because you,
went, it, you see that you guys product. Came back with a vengeance. I mean, it must have really saved the company.
Well, think about that, right? Like, right. Well, yeah, all these guys, you know, put their brains and their muscles together and made it through. And look what then happens, right? Then after that, we have a influx of financial stability,
right,
and that allows, you know, us to start, you know, create not just creating other IPs and maybe taking a little bit more of a risk, but you know Gabe and a group of others start developing Steam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that then is another revolutionary force, right? And
I don't think anyone who buys a game on a PC usually buys it through Steam.
I know. And I'm working at Riot Games now, and I've been there for 3 years, and another fantastic company. I've been extremely lucky.
Yeah.
I've been at Valve, and now I'm at Riot. And but yeah, when I'm walking around, I always see Steam up on everybody's computer. Mm-hmm. I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
The people like it.
Yeah. It works.
It works.
Well, that's really great. When did you transition to Riot? So, like, how long were you at Valve then? So
I was at Valve for almost, no, it was 11 years.
11 years.
11 years.
So, yeah.
So I worked on, I worked from Half-Life 2, Counter-Strike, Day of Defeat, Team Fortress 2, mm-hmm. the Left 4 Deads, the Portals.
Oh, really? The Portal stuff.
Yes.
Oh,
I worked on Alien Swarm and Dota 2.
Wow.
So, you know, that was a good run, you know, after...
And did you ever start picking up Photoshop a little bit more at this point?
Oh, my God. Yeah, oh, yeah. After a while, yeah. I'm doing, like, you know, helping out with texturing and
sure.
And then, well, then you realize, like, character design, you know, you have to do things really, really quick.
Right.
That was great for setting up an initial look. That's during the, you know, like, when you're doing research and development and... Mm-hmm. But then when you're getting into pre-production, you gotta jam on it.
Yeah.
You gotta take all those principles and start doing a lot of testing. And that's what pre-production is all about. So that once you get to the end of pre-production, that's when you're actually coming in and basically doing a design doc.
Right.
So that it actually becomes scalable, right? That's one of the important parts of creating a game is, like, can it be manufactured in a cost-effective way?
Right.
At the same time, like, bringing joy to the people that are working on it, because nobody wants to go through a 6 year or a 3 year, you know, year slog of hell to get something out. I know of a lot of friends from past companies that have had to do that, and it's not fun. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to live your life that way.
Sure.
So,
sure.
Yeah. So, I don't know how many I'm trying to count the number of games at Valve I worked on, but yeah, it was a wonderful education.
Awesome.
That was my second education,
right?
And I got to work with.
Well, you didn't, you know, guys. Think about you as a boy growing up in the Caribbean and some random thing. Think about you'd be designing video games?
No.
Right.
No. Yeah, no. Exactly. And you know,
and were you playing many video games? You've never really played.
I played arcade games.
Sure.
And being in the Caribbean, what do you do? I wouldn't stay inside and play video games. You know, that was, I wasn't one of those kids. I did have a friend that had, you know, a game system, but you know, when I'd go over to their house, I was the guy that would be like, I'll see you guys later. I'm going to walk down the beach and go surfing and and sailing. Thank you.
Yeah.
That was my video game, right? Or that was my game.
Right.
I wanted to be out. I wanted to be exploring, you know.
Yep.
And then, of course, you know, puberty hits.
Yeah. And then you're looking for girls.
then there's that other game.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, that's, I love that story. But I want to talk a little bit about your style and what you do. Mm. And also the fact that you've done a lot of characters, right?
Yeah.
So characters are our thing, and you've got a very specific style to them, and they're great. Do you do much environments? You do some environments.
I love to do environments. Okay. I haven't done much lately, but I'm getting back into it.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, these last couple of years, I mean, I've worked on, you know, the Summoner's Rift update and some other things, but at Riot, but to really focus in on environments. I think that environments have such an extremely important role. They're very, you know, they can either make or break an entire game,
of course,
because everything has to have context. And
right.
In a game, it's not just about the immersion and the believability, but there's gameplay involved, right? Mm-hmm. It's visual language that you're,
right.
So it's not art for art's sake, right? It's art everything has to have a very good intention to it.
You know,
has to have intention. So, but yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call it my style. It's really what the you know, what I perceive the what is it? The game kind of, or games in general, want me to create. I just don't like doing little detail stuff.
Okay.
Because I figure when characters are in the game, it's not about the folds. It's not about the little, you know, pieces of fabric.
Sure.
It's really about, you know, the animations, you know, are extremely important. So it's really the orchestration of the entire thing that happens. Uh-huh. And I really like simplifying it down, you know, to its core essence, rather than like self-flagellation and trying to like put, folds on a pocket, when you're never going to see it.
Right.
You know, so bypass all that stuff and come up with a proper read hierarchy.
Right? Okay.
So that's why I design the way I do for games. I don't do that when I do an oil painting though.
Okay.
So I'll actually do soft edges and, but there are some very similar principles on how you would approach it. Right. So in painting, unless you're really, you know, want to kill yourself, you know, getting into those small little details. But for me, it's like, keep it impressionistic, you know, keep it simplified.
Right. I've been talking to a few people here, some of the attendees, a lot of the young guys that are going out there, they're soaking stuff up like a sponge, which is always great. I think, you know,
oh my God, they're so good.
It's so, and they're so talented.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And so they sit here and they're going, they're just in awe of us. And I'm in awe of them.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I think that's, and also, you know, for me, someone who's done this for a while, when you go to a lot of conferences, it's a lot of the old veterans and it's just, we're not as excited, right? But you have these young people here and they're showing their huge eyes and it gets you so excited again.
It does. It does. It definitely brings in a little bit more enjoyment. Because after a while, you get, you know, it's
just jaded.
You do get jaded, you know? And I also think that it's very, very important to take some time for tea, you know? Mm-hmm. So to take a little bit of time off and don't just think about a career progression. Mm-hmm. I remember when, you know, I was sometimes at my best when I was at, you know, my worst in some ways, right?
Okay.
When I was, you know, in financial hell, you're gonna work even harder, right?
Sure.
And smarter in some way to make that work.
Right.
Or sometimes, you know, at this point, like, I've been working for, 15 years.
Right.
And kind of like 15 years straight. Mm-hmm. It would be fun to be like, I'm going to take 6 months off to travel, you know? But just to get that level of excitement back, you know? But yeah, all these kids, man, they're not kids. I mean, they're doing such fantastic.
I feel old.
Yeah. See, it's just a comparative thing.
But they're really exciting. And so I was asking some of them and about stuff, and I was talking about, you know, character work and environment, and so many of them are just like character.
Everybody's character. I don't get it.
And
I don't
they understand. Have no. It's like, yeah, environments are boring. You're static.
My God. Well, I used to work with a guy named Jeff Ballinger at Valve. Uh-huh. Right. This guy was. He did all the textures for Half-Life 2.
Okay.
Okay. And he was really good with like just the making of the photorealism, mm-hmm. right? Which was a craft within itself, because you don't just take a photo and then put it in Photoshop and ship it, right? You have to really
Light it correctly.
You have to light it correctly. You have to, you know, you have to take out all the visual noise so it's not competing, you know, within the world. So I'm talking with him about his approach, and that's just like, wow, that's, you know, he's really putting his mind to it, right? Mm-hmm. He's really thinking about his hierarchy. He joins a team for Team Fortress 2, and he goes in this totally different direction. He goes more that Miyazaki hand-painted approach. At the same time, like he hadn't really been doing any world design in the sense of world building, and this was his opportunity. This is all of our opportunities to kind of have an ownership over the game.
Right.
And watching him do environment design, I was like, I want to try. I would like to try that too. And I realized how amazing it is to create worlds. I mean, you're creating worlds that you can interact in. And a character is kind of just this vehicle that runs around. You know?
Yeah.
But the world is this exploration.
I think, so the thing is, I think that a lot of people like character because they want to tell a story, and the only way they can tell a story is through the voice of a character, possibly. And the environment is not, it's harder to tell a story with an environment. Mm. But environment is experiential, it's emotional, right?
Absolutely.
Much more directly in a lot of ways, especially if it's a really good environment,
right? Oh, if it's really good.
Yeah. You get the amazing, it's like, holy shit. You know, why the hell do you think people travel to go experience environments?
Totally. Right? I looked at early explorations for Half-Life. I think this was before Viktor Antonov even got there. And I think it was going to be based in New York, or it was going to be based in this more futuristic sci-fi, right? And look what Viktor does, right? He goes in and he's like, no. He's from Bulgaria.
Okay.
And that's where, you know, City 17 is based.
Okay.
In Sofia. So he actually, he didn't go back to Bulgaria. However, he asked his brother to take, like, just case the entire city.
Okay.
And so
I've been to Bulgaria several times.
You've been? Okay.
Yeah, my company's based there.
Oh, awesome. Really? I had no idea.
Yeah.
So he, you know, and this is, I learned from this guy, right? Like he teaches us about this immersiveness, right? And you don't go into City 17 and it's all futuristic, right? It's actually not at all. It's very kind of scary. It's Stasi state, right? Mm-hmm. It's very, everything's kind of cold and dilapidated. And yet you see this citadel, this futuristic citadel. Mm-hmm. So there's actually a ratio. So he's using like 90% realism and 10% of this, like, whoa, it's kind of, you know, sci-fi approach. Mm-hmm. So you always know, like in the city, that you always see the citadel, right? And
it's,
and
that's a
measurement device.
It
is what?
It orients you too.
It's an orient device, exactly. Yeah. But it's also a very powerful device in the sense that, you know, sprinkled within the city, there are, you know, elements of the Combine, you know, the alien technologies, and the, you know, the police force and all that. So I guess it's just like you know, I see so many games now where it's all like this futuristic world, and they strip out all of the soul. Well, there's no foundations, right? Mm-hmm. Like in a world, you know, it's just like, okay, it's all futuristic and everybody's running around, you know, with this, you know, super, like, costume and, I don't know. But environments, yes, have a very important part to play, and we're all very, very sensitive to them as well, right? Like, we both live in L.A.
Right.
You know, and I live in Santa Monica, but when I'm in a car, when I have to, like, drive into the city, It's like so ugly. Yeah. You know, it's a car culture anyways, right? So it's just like, here, I'll just drive past this disgusting, you know, these boxes basically and right. strip malls everywhere to right. get to my house, but I'll stop in to get a burger, right. you know, but it's just out of convenience.
Right, right, right.
You know, and you compare that to maybe Lisbon or to Paris or, right. you know, San Francisco.
Sure. I think different. That everything has a little bit of a difference to it in a sure. sense. There's, you know, I lived in all kinds of places. I lived in Cairo. So that's my where God. I was born.
You were born in Cairo.
Yeah. What? And then I lived in Athens in Greece. Then I lived in, you know, sort of suburban town outside of New York City. And then I lived in Houston, Texas. And then I lived in LA. And, you know, every place, it could look really beautiful when you first go there. And it's like, oh, my God, this is amazing.
Yes.
Or it could be, what the fuck am I doing here? When I went to Houston, I was like, ugh. And I was going to architecture school, too. So I was like, great, because I want to see inspired by stuff. And it just wasn't that pretty, right? No. But there are some amazing places. You just have to find them. And that's another thing that's actually kind of fun is finding things.
Yes,
yeah?
yes.
And looking for great
gleaning.
Things. Right. Yeah. And there was actually lots of incredible architecture in Houston and lots of good stuff, but it was a different environment. And I think the idea of exploring is kind of cool. Right, here's why I'm bringing up the whole environment thing, because it's something that's on my mind. And I think that, you know, I'm glad you said you really enjoy them and you understand them. But
yeah,
what's going on now in games is obviously there's been a big push for this whole virtual reality thing, which I think is valid.
Yeah.
I think it's also something that's the problem I have now is that the virtual reality stuff, the content that's put on it is not attractive necessarily.
Yeah.
And people need to design beautiful environments to go to. You need to have a reason why you're putting on this headset.
Of course.
And I don't know why people don't focus on beautiful designs, environments for VR. And
look at the vast, I mean, we live in a world, right?
That, right.
I mean, you can certainly build. Imagine the, you know, the people that don't have access, right? A person that is, you know, possibly handicapped
sure.
in some way or form where they can't, you know, travel abroad.
Right.
They can't go to the Louvre. You know, they can't go to Musée d'Orsay. They can't, you know, they can't right. go to, you know, Prague.
Right.
And they can put this goggle on,
right?
Right, and actually become a part of it,
right?
Walk around a little bit, you know, really yeah. experience it. And I totally agree. I had this discussion with one of the Valve guys a couple of months ago about that, and he was just like, "Yeah, wouldn't that be cool if somebody came up with that?" And yet, no, you know, nobody's doing that type of thing.
Yeah, I think it's just I think it's like anything. New technology, they always focus on the technology first, and,
yes.
and they tend to not necessarily pay attention to the aesthetics of things for hopefully not too much longer. But
right.
Yeah, and I think it's really cool that like Valve got very involved in. You know, their new, the HTC Vive, right? I know that the game environment or the game culture is an important part of it. But I still think that, just like you were saying, they should make things like go travel to, you know, to wherever.
Right,
you know?
An exploration.
Exploration.
Right? Just a simple exploration that you right. can, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, a gameplay.
No.
Mode, right? It's literally like you can exist inside of this world,
right?
And it doesn't necessarily be even an interaction with people there,
right?
You know, actually, that would be cool if you actually could, you know, interact with other people that are
while they're in there.
Yeah, well, yeah, like a, you know, like a World of Warcraft.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, the people come. Well, it kind of also be kind of scary to have, you know, you definitely get a lot of trolls. I'm sure.
Oh, I'm sure. Well, you know, I was listening to. Kevin Margo's talk today, and he was talking about the first game that sort of got him really excited was Riven, which is derivative of Myst, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that game, you just literally just teleport from location to location solving problems. And that's great. That would be a fantastic VR experience.
I think so as well. Yeah.
So, but the reason he loved it is because it was so beautiful, right? And so that's the thing that's important. And the guys who designed that, they designed it that way. They designed these vistas and these places to go.
Yeah, yeah.
So, well, yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, no, I totally agree. And I think that that is a wonderful, that would be a wonderful approach to it.
Right.
And the thing that's dangerous to it for VR is like that fear factor.
Uh-huh.
You know, you probably could get a heart attack if you're not careful, you know, because when you put this thing on, you get scared to death, right. Literally. So it's kind of like, it's important to figure out. You know, I like puzzle games are fantastic for that. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, I totally agree.
So has where Riot is now, obviously the VR must be something that they are focused on, and if that is that something that affects you? Have you noticed a change of things that you have to do now that possibly you have to design not just vistas but like full environments?
Well, I mean, we are like exploring a variety of different R&D projects.
Sure,
I really can't unfortunately go into that because
that's fine.
But the value, I'll just say that, right?
Right.
Like we're definitely valuing.
Right.
And evaluating,
sure,
those types of things.
And how has that affected your work?
Oh my gosh, it's with what I'm doing specifically right now, which part I can tell you, I'm working on League of Legends, right? But
At
the same time, I'm working on other R&D things, and
sure.
it could drastically affect you. Oh yeah, of course.
Yeah, but I'm wondering what what will be, if, for example, games become much more VR-centric, how is designing and how is conceptualizing that space going to be?
My goodness.
Yeah.
Do
you have any speculation?
I really don't. But, I mean, I know that, especially after, playtesting the Vive and that, you can model in it. You can paint in 3D. Like, that can be part of a gameplay,
mm-hmm.
but there's going to be a variety of other things. Like what else goes into that? So
yeah. Do you see yourself as designing within virtual reality or drawing or illustrating?
Well, yeah. I mean, like you could do that, or it could be used as a gameplay device in some way or form, or some form of entertainment or some form of, social collaboration,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, hey, let's all get together and design a sculpture.
Right.
And all of your friends get together. So it could be just as simple as that.
Okay. Well, you said you're working on League of Legends, but you also obviously can't talk about other stuff.
No.
Is there anything else that's fine. Is there anything else that you have going on?
Starting to get back into oil painting again.
Nice.
I took a little vacation.
Yeah.
I met Phil Hale, who's one of my like gods from when I was in art school days. So he's here at THU 2016. Yeah. I had the opportunity to sit with him at lunch a couple of days ago, and I had 2 hours of talk
right
with this guy.
Right.
And
right.
like it exceeded expectations.
Nice.
He's such a wonderful person. And I was using terminologies and he would correct me. But in the right way.
Okay.
So I learned this bad habit of saying like happy mistakes. Like when you're doing an oil painting, for example, and he's like, it's not a mistake.
Right.
It's not no. You're kind of just taking from Bob Ross here, right?
Right.
And I was
right.
I am. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And then he's like, no. It's all, you are being very premeditated when you're doing an oil painting. And he's 100% correct.
Right.
Like you're forming and constructing. You're laying down foundational elements to compose and
right.
and so that last paintbrush stroke before you drop that mic.
Yeah.
Proverbial mic. You know, it's this orchestration. And I was just like, oh, I love you.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm getting back into oil painting and,
sure.
and getting into gouache again.
Yeah.
Sketching. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
And so what are you doing at THU? I think you're doing some of the collab stuff, right?
Right. We're helping basically like mentor for the collabs.
Okay.
I'm on team.
Can you explain a little bit what the collabs is?
Oh yeah. Okay. So it's we have I think it's if I'm correct, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I think we have 6 groups of 10 people.
Okay.
Including the mentors.
Right.
And it's a collaboration. It's this kind of experiment of randomly selected people that have opted into the collabs. And they're basically like, what do you guys, for the next few days, for 9 hours, basically, it's 3 hours a day, what do you guys want to do, right? Mm-hmm. And we as mentors, we help facilitate, but in no way do we direct.
Yeah.
So we're relying on that team to collaborate with one another to create something that's tangible at right. the end.
And these are people that may not necessarily know how to collaborate yet. Because right. they've been doing things independently for so long, right?
It might exactly, right. exactly. And yeah, like one guy's from, you know, in art school. A couple of other, like two are art directors.
Okay.
Another one works at a game company, mm-hmm. you know. And so like, yeah, everybody comes from someplace. On our team specifically, we're working on a side scroller.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're actually doing a fantastic job. Like wow. I think they're ahead of the game right now. We actually have a working prototype. Mm-hmm. We have an actual art style fleshed out. This is in, you know, at that point that was within 7 hours.
Wow.
In 7 hours. Right. Wow. And again, like we're very hands off. If there's a technical issue, like we're coming in and helping out, mm-hmm. and basically just saying, hey guys, you have a half an hour, you've got 20 minutes, 10, not, you know, mm-hmm. it's just like, but these are the guys that are actually making it. I think for them, they're out of, the work life that they're normally in. Right. So right. they're actually creating, with a group that's just like scattered marbles, but okay. like, how do you make that work in this very aggressive time frame?
Sure.
And I think that they're learning a lot of lessons that okay. sometimes you don't need a boss, but sometimes you do, right? Right. But you don't need a boss that basically holds your hand, right? That's right. not the right kind of boss that treats you like a widget.
Right.
You want somebody that basically a really great boss is a person that kind of supports you from below and treats you in such a way that you can use the best of your own potentials.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the things that we're doing as well. But there's also like, we have one of the guys that's basically responsible for importing all the images and orchestrating the entire thing. He's an art director.
Okay.
He owns his own company.
Right.
But he's not task managing, and like he's helping deliver, you know, a very important part of the game at this point.
Okay, okay.
And he's just loving the hell of it because he doesn't have to art direct.
Right, right.
So,
well, that's awesome. Yeah, and this is a complaint I've heard, especially from, you know, people, some of the lecturers and stuff, or the speakers, is that they're sad because they spend so much time in meetings and
my gosh,
it's terrible.
Yeah, don't you don't want to become an art director, okay?
You want to still, yeah. If you still love painting, then don't become an art director.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly. If you love craft and yeah, I love it. I love it too. But at the same time, like I'm at the point in my life where I do enjoy mentorship.
Right.
So on the floor at Riot, I'm mostly like a principal artist, right? So I do a lot of mentoring, and we have 90 artists on the floor. We have,
wow.
You know, over 500, you know, devs.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I'm enjoying the process of being taught as well. But mm-hmm. I'm also like I'm just helping, you know, 90 artists level up craft, you know,
yeah.
skills, and it's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, this has been really great. I really appreciate you doing this talk.
My pleasure.
It was
absolutely
fun. And we'll do our little Polaroid
okay.
in a second.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks so much, Robbie.
You got it.